welcome back to All Things Running, Red Rock Running Company's weekly podcast. My name is Eric Herdman. I am the owner of Red Rock Running Company and your host for this edition of All Things Running. Past couple episodes, we've been doing some interviews and giving you some valuable information that way. This week, we have a three-part show. And the first part is reader and listener Q&A. Our second part is a look at some new software for those of you using Suunto watches or those of you that have been waiting for some better software to come out for Suunto watches. We're going to look at MovesCount and MovesCount.com. And in the third part of our show today, we're going to look at a few new products in the store that I think are probably safety products. And you'll see what I mean when I get to that section. But first up, reader and listener Q&A. We get a lot of questions in the store about running, and I thought it would be appropriate to do a podcast on some of the top or most frequently asked questions that we get in the store, and so that's what I've done. We went to our listeners of the podcast, to the people that follow us and follow the store on the Facebook page that we have, and to our Twitter account, and said, what are your questions about running that we could help you with? You can ask us anything. We'll try to answer them. And so what we did was the staff at the store, myself, and then we kind of bounced some questions off some other people. So we were giving you what we thought was the very best information instead of it just being from one person in the store, from myself, that kind of thing. We kind of bounced these questions around. So what you're getting in this section is a variety of questions about running. And the information as far as the answer was pulled from a variety of different people, some beginners, some more experienced, some that do coaching, some that do shorter distances of 5 and 10K, and all the way up to marathoners and ultramarathoners helped me answer these questions. So first up, question number one, what's a good starting place for a beginner runner who wants to eventually run longer distance races? Well, my answer to that one would be, and again, when I say my answer, the answer that we've put together for this question, is to get comfortable with running, get good at running, really like running. Don't force yourself into running longer races until you've had some really good experiences at the shorter distances that that are out there. And what I'm referring to is, you know, the weekend 5 and 10Ks that are all over town, those are really good places to start for a beginner runner who wants to go into running longer distance races. And it's common sense, conventional wisdom, whatever you want to call it, that you start small and you work yourself up to longer and longer distances. But instead of just saying go out and run some races, I think that you should probably get good at running some shorter, faster distances, if you will, and get comfortable with training and really like running and like running in different places and different climates first. And if you sounds corny or if you think this is silly, but I find it to be true, I think you need to find yourself as a runner. I think you need to get comfortable in your skin as a runner before you start venturing out into longer and longer races. And I have another question coming up that addresses the ultra issue of transitioning to ultras, and the answer will sound the same. But I think that for this question, the starting place is get yourself in some shorter races, get comfortable as a runner, and then start picking a little bit longer races as you master some of the shorter races. Question number two, how does one transition from running marathons and half marathons into doing an ultra? So piggybacking on question number one, we now take it a step further and looking much more specific. This question assumes that someone is running at least half marathons, preferably marathons, and then they want to do an ultra. Get asked this question all the time in the store. And it's a good question. And it's a scary question for people to think about how to answer this question. You know, how do I do this? You know, it was kind of easy and took only common sense to realize that once I finished a half marathon and kind of got that right and kind of was happy with what I was doing there, that I want to run a marathon. And so you found a marathon and then you went and did the marathon. Now, running a half marathon and running a marathon are about the same. Because let's just say it's a like a rock and roll marathon or a marathon in a larger city like Chicago or something like that. You find a half marathon, it's a city marathon down and around the city, through the streets, maybe through a park, finish line, you're done. A marathon, more than likely, is just that for 26.2 miles through the city, through a park, you know, a little bit longer, 26.2 miles, and I'm done. But when you start thinking about an ultra, you get a lot more because, first of all, a lot of them are run on very challenging courses. I know that goes against everything. Thinking, well, I'm going to run longer. Why wouldn't they just kind of make some easy ones out there? Well, there are some easier ultras, but that's kind of a joke in the ultra community. People ask you, well, what's an easy 100-mile race to do? Well, there's not. There's no such thing as an easy 100-miler. But back to the question. Transitioning from marathon to ultra is, again, again, back to question number one, common sense rules here. I do a marathon, I probably should look for a 50K, which is a little bit over 31 miles, and that would be an ultra distance. I think, though, that instead of just saying that as an answer, and we get a chance in the store to kind of back this up a little bit and have a discussion with people that are in the store, instead of just saying go do a 50K after you've done a couple marathons, I think we need to qualify that a little bit. I think you need to get good at running marathons. Now, I don't think you need to have a really fast PR, and I don't think you need to run 10 before you run an ultra. But I think in some cases, with some people, that running one marathon may not be enough before you go do an ultra. You know, when it's been done, and there have been people that have bypassed running a marathon and done an ultra. That's fine if you can pull it off. I have a feeling that the questions that we get asked about this, people want to do it so it makes sense, so they don't get hurt, so they don't have a bad experience. And that's kind of what I'm all about when I answer this question. I don't want to just say, yeah, you run a marathon, go do a half, or go do an ultra. That's not right. I think you need to get good at the marathon. I think you need to have mastered a couple things. Let me give you some specifics. I think you need to have mastered your training for a marathon. I don't think you should have run five marathons, all of them with injuries. That's not mastering the marathon. I think you need to be satisfied with your PR, not everybody else's expectation of what you can do, but your PR in the marathon. And if not, stay with running marathons until you do. I think you need to have mastered the hydration and nutrition strategy that you've chosen during a marathon. And I think that is probably an area where people really need to go back and take a look at. You know, did I do enough with my hydration? Did I do enough with my electrolytes? Did I not eat any gel for 26.2 miles? You will not be able to take that same strategy into an ultra. I am afraid that you will have a very bad experience in an ultra if you try to get by on nothing and not having a sound hydration and electrolyte and nutrition program in place. So I think once you've mastered those things with the marathon, and again, mastery, I don't want to scare you like you have to be really, really good at it or have done a lot of them, but you feel like, yeah, I'm comfortable with what I've done with marathon, then I think you need to start looking for an ultra. And I think that, again, back to common sense, says, you know, find a 50K race to start with. Don't pick the most challenging, the hardest 50K. You know, don't pick the most technical trail, the one with the most climbing, the one with the most descending. Pick something that makes sense for your ability going into this, and then do it. And as far as the training goes, people say, well, then what do I do with the training? As far as the training goes, if you're doing a 50K, I think the most conservative approach is to take your marathon training and lengthen the long run that you've done. I think your weekly runs can stay about the same. I say about. Some people will do a little bit more. But I think that long run needs to be bumped up just a little bit for 50K, remembering that's just a little over 31 miles. And I think you'll be fine. So good luck with that one. Question number three. Does a running shoe need to be broken in? And if so, how much time should it be used before I use it in a race? Good question. One that we try to address every time we do a shoe fitting in the store. We take someone through a shoe fitting with a treadmill analysis and look at them, and they try on a bunch of shoes, and they go outside and they run in them a little bit, and they come back in and they have some feedback, and then we switch into and try another shoe on, and the process continues until they find one they like. One of the first things in a series of questions that they ask, and we want them to ask, is, so do I need to break this in? And the answer is no. And yes. And here's what I mean. Way back in the day, when I first started selling running shoes in the 80s, the materials were not as soft and supple and as technical as they are now. And we used to have to recommend, that conversation of at the end of the fitting was a lot different back in the 80s than it is now. Back then we had to tell people, you know what, you might want to wear them around your house for a couple days. You know, accumulate a few hours of running in them before you take them out for a run. And then that first run should probably be very, very, very short as you build up, you know, some time in the shoe. And then it becomes your training shoe. But now, the way the materials are, they're so soft and supple, and they're so technical, and the seams are flat. If there are some shoe companies don't have any seams at all. So if there are any seams at all in the shoe... And this is an advantage to you, the consumer, investing in a pair of shoes, because you could basically get fitted, be comfortable in the shoe, and wear it at home, check it out for maybe 15 to 20 minutes, and if everything is good, it's good to go out and run. I've actually taken shoes that reps have sent me to try out, or I have a couple shoes that I really like. I just grab another pair and put them on, and I can go out and easily do a 25, 30 miler in them and not have a problem. So the answer there is no, they don't need to be broken in like you may think way back in the day, old school style. How much time should a shoe be used before a race? Let's take a question that comes up around Las Vegas Marathon time and half marathon, and people come in and they say, all right, I got my training shoes for the summer. How many pair of shoes am I going to have to buy? And we explain to them the life cycle of a shoe, the lifetime of a shoe. And they say, well, so I'll need a couple pairs before the race. Yes. And then they say, well, when should I buy my last pair before the race? And a real good answer is enough time so that you have the shoe to do your last long run in it before the race. So let's say, for example, you do a two-week taper and your last long run is 2 weeks out. I would get the shoes a few days before that, do a few shorter runs in them, do my long run in them, and then that shoe is ready to go for your race. If you do that last long run in it and you don't have any problems, I mean, you're good to go. And if you've been training in the same shoe, you're going to be really good to go. So I think that's the best answer for that one. Next question. How important is having a race strategy? I don't know that I would go to the starting line without one. And that sounds really serious when you think about the question. How important is a race strategy? Someone out there running a 4 or 5 hour marathon is probably looking at this going, you know, dude, all I want to do is just get to the finish line. I just want to finish. Well, just finishing is a goal. That's an end result. That's not a strategy for getting there. There are so many people, I'm like, so what do you got planned for the race? What's going to happen? And they say, I just want to finish. I'm like, great, that's a goal. You've got to have a goal, and I agree with that. But what is your strategy? What's your plan? And they don't have one. And those people don't have a really good experience. And again, getting back to something I said earlier, I think that if you're a beginner and that race strategy question scares you, I think you should be scared, because I think you need to have a strategy, because if you don't have a strategy, you're going to have a bad experience. And I, when I work with beginners, I like them to be having a good experience running. I love running. It's the best thing in the world. I mean, there's just something about it that's really, really cool. And whether it's in a race or just on an idle Tuesday run, I think it ought to be a pleasant experience. And I think the only way to invest all the time and money into racing is to go to the race with a strategy. And the goal is fine. And if it's just to finish, it's just to finish. If it's to finish in 3 hours and 15 minutes, if it's a marathon, that's fine. If it's a 5K and I want to do a 20-minute 5K, that's fine. What's your plan to get there? And so I think it is super important to have a race strategy. And I think that that goes back to breaking down your training and looking what's realistic as far as the finishing time. And that's, of course, the goal. And then working it backwards into the strategy. What do I need to run per mile to get to that goal? What do I need to eat or drink before, during, after to make that happen? You know what? You could even really break this down and get really analytical and look at a race strategy as the way you craft your training for the race. So I think it's important to have a race strategy. And I could go on and on about race strategy and planning. But to answer the reader's question, yeah, it's super important no matter what level you're at. Next question. How much difference does speed work and or tempo runs make while training for longer distance races? The answer to that one's, we could be done real quick, makes a lot of difference. But let me explain. If your goal is to just finish, you probably aren't going to spend much time doing speed workout and tempo runs. So to that person, the answer isn't a lot. If you're wanting to finish in a certain time, then you're probably going to have to spend some time training running faster than your goal race pace. That's about the only way that's going to happen. They found that even the people that just run tremendous amounts of what used to be called LSD, long, slow distance, go to race day, and all they can run is long, slow distance. The real success is in the proper blend, and boy, that's a big, big area there, the proper blend of speed and distance work to get you to your goal pace. Let's go down another road with it. People always ask about, do you need to do speed workout, tempo work, accelerated type pace work when you're doing a marathon or an ultra? And the answer is, of course, and again, back to the LSD from the 70s and 80s, you know, people used to go out and just, you know, run for hours at a 10-minute pace and go to a race and wonder why they couldn't run any faster than 10-minute pace. It's because they'd never done it in training. They were extremely fit at 10-minute pace, but they couldn't go any faster. And when they did, they blew up, and it was a horrible experience. Back to the experience again. Whereas if you took someone and said, you know what, I need a middle distance run of the week. I need some recovery runs. I've got to have, of course, a long run. I probably better have a run with some hills on it because my race is on a hilly course. No, I got to put in a speed or tempo day. When you put that together, that puzzle of those workouts together, and you blend them together, I mean, that's magical, because that's when you make goal times or exceed goal times. That's when the race is a pleasant experience, or as close to pleasant as you can, you know, can have. But I think that it's key. I started ultramarathoning when the mode of training was just to go out and just put miles in. I mean, it was just like, who could run the most miles a week? And it was ridiculous. And of course you get injuries, and other guys were getting injured because of just trying to put in more miles than the next guy. And of course a guy would win a race that ran 180 miles a week, and so then everybody thought they had to run 180 miles a week. And over the past 5 years, 6 years of ultra marathoning, to give you some reference here, we've realized that 180 miles a week is not for everybody. 140 miles a week is not for everybody. And if it is, not everybody can maintain that for too long. It may be used as a build-up strategy for a big race. But what we found is that even at those 50 mile, 100K, 100-mile distances, even 24-hour races, some tempo or leg speed or speed work is a benefit, is an asset. And I really think that that's the best answer I can give you. And I practice that now. I don't go out and just pack on a bunch of miles just to say I ran X number of miles a week. I mean, there's definitely a load of quality miles in my weekly makeup of training. The next question is from a Twitter follower. How important do you think genetics are in one's ability to succeed as a runner? A ton. It's a joke in the running community that if you want to get faster as a runner, if you want to get really fast as a runner, as a distance runner, you need to do this. Choose your parents very well. And if you pause for a moment, you think about that, and it's too late. Yes, so genetics are huge, and let's just leave it there. Because you know what? I can't just say that and feel good about it. Yes, genetics are super important because I'm just going to burst everybody's bubble. And the people that want an excuse to not be good now have it, and I'm going to rain on your parade right now by saying, but you know what? Why don't you just go run? Why don't you not worry about what genetics you were given and just go enjoy running? And I think that's the best advice I could give anybody, even if somebody out there who wants to really race well. You know what? Go ahead and train to race well. Don't worry about the genetics. If that's what you want to do, if you want to get faster, then push yourself. Come up with a plan to get faster and do it. And if you know what? You think, oh, I don't have the right body makeup to do a marathon. Well, you know what? Forget it. Forget about it. Go run a marathon. Don't worry about that you're a big-boned, 6'3", 222-pound runner. Seen a lot of them run really well. And I don't think they crossed the finish line setting a PR for themselves, worrying about their genetics. I think they just said, you know what, I'm going to do it because I enjoy running and I'm going to get it done. I'm going to have the best experience possible. So there's my answer for that one. Next question. Facebook follower of the Red Rock Running Company Facebook page writes in and says, does weight training, you know, lifting, make a difference in running pace and form? Yes, to a certain degree. I have a small little bit of background in exercise physiology, exercise science. And the first day in an exercise physiology class many, many years ago, talk about old school, professor walks in and says, first thing you got to know about exercise science, exercise physiology, and that is the law of sport specificity. And he went on for the next hour to explain that if you're going to run, you're going to run. And if you're going to run on a hilly course, you better run hills. And if you're going to be a rower, you better row. And if you're going to be a swimmer, you better swim. And if you're going to play football, you better play football. I think you get what I'm saying. However, there are some benefits to working the body in a way that it is not normally worked in your sport-specific sport. And that comes into play big time when you talk about the repetitive movements of many endurance sports. So the benefit of lifting is key in certain aspects of running. Postural strength, postural fitness. In other words, the ability to hold one body in a position that is good or healthy or normal or natural, however you want to think of it, for a long period of time under the load of exercise and under the stress of being and increasingly becoming fatigued is key. And it's been shown for many years now that strength training will do that. And of course, when we talk about posture, we're talking about the muscles of the core, the hips, the mid back, the upper back, and the neck. And those things have shown to make a significant difference in your running. Arm strength, quad strength, the calf, that kind of thing. There's less significant evidence and proof of that being key, but anytime that you talk to anybody that's in the know on this stuff, they will refer to postural strength or body positioning strength. And those muscles of the hips and the stabilizers on the hips and the low back and, again, mid back and even up in the neck, anything along the spine, find that if it can be strengthened and trained with weights, resistance training, you do gain a benefit as a runner. Next question. How can I get rid of side stitches during my training runs and races? More than likely, a side stitch is from one or two reasons. The first reason that someone gets a side stitch is usually the weak abdominal muscles or weak low back muscles. And again, I'm thinking of the core, the band around the middle of the body becomes weak, and it just doesn't like all the jostling and the impact, and the jostling and the impact combined. And so what happens is you get a little side stitch. The other cause of a side stitch is food. And it's fixed with food by timing. And most of the time you need to just eat a little bit further, put a little bit more time, let me say it this way, put a little bit more time between when you eat and when you run. A lot of times people are eating too close to when they run, and again, the stomach just doesn't like that, or some digestion has started to take place, and food in the colon doesn't like the jostling and the movement and the impact, and so that will start to cause a little stitch. And that can, of course, then go into full-blown, you know, cramping and abdominal distress and a lot of ugly things. So I think that the first one is fixed by the weak core muscles is fixed by working the core and making those abdominal muscles a little stronger. I think the second problem is just kind of journaling, keeping track of when you're eating and when you're running and what the experience was like. And eventually you'll find out that, you know, hey, well, I need to eat my lunch, you know, 3 hours before my run, or I need to eat my bar, early morning bar before I go work out, you know, an hour and a half before, or I need to stop drinking coffee at least an hour before I go out for a run. Those type of things will probably help you with the food issue and the side stitch. Someone that listened to the podcast a couple weeks ago had this question: what are the basic necessities that beginning runners need? Not much. And, you know, people always ask about the store, you know, in the economy. They're like, how's the store doing? You know, the store's doing great. And you, the customers, the people that come in the store, are telling us that and showing us that and making that happen. And what I mean by that is that you're coming into the store and you're making purchases and you're buying shoes and you're saying things like, yeah, this is the greatest stress relief in these tough times that I've got, is to strap on a pair of shoes and go out and run and blow off that steam and that stress. And I think that kind of gets back to the very primal thing that goes into running, or what I call the playground effect of running. As adults, we don't get much playground time. And if you think about it, man, that recess bell would ring, or they'd kick open that door, you'd go outside and, man, you would tear it up, ripping around, running around, having a good time. And as adults, we don't get that anymore. Running is that playground time. It takes us back to the very beginning of what was play, what was fun. And you just don't get that in the corporate world, or at your job with your boss hanging over you all the time, and then, you know, with the stressful times of money and the economy and those things. You know, the wonders of a 45-minute run after a stressful day, can't beat it. One customer actually put it this way. He said, you know what, investing in these running shoes, this $100 for these running shoes and, you know, 20, 30 more in socks, beats psychiatric help. And I immediately looked at him and said, I know what you mean. I get that, because I'm a big believer in just opening up the door someday and just going and running. There is really no other purpose than just, I'm just headed out to run to blow off some steam. So the basic necessities, to be very specific to the person who did write this question, would be obviously some running shoes that are, you know, fitted for you and that you're very comfortable in. A good sock, because you can have the best running shoe, but if you're still running in cheap socks, you're going to have blister and still be uncomfortable in that shoe if the sock doesn't fit correctly. I think then some technical clothing would probably be next on the list, just to avoid having a bad experience with chafing or materials that hold a lot of sweat. That's not good. And from there, the rest of it is pretty much extra stuff. If you're going to do marathon, you know, training or half marathon training, you're probably going to need some gels and some electrolytes and some things to hold, you know, hydration, water products in, electrolyte drinks in. But other than that, I mean, basic, if you talk basic necessities, we're back to footwear and some basic comfortable running apparel, and you are set. And the last question. And I saved this one for last because I had to verify that it really did come in, and then everybody kind of laughed. But then I thought about it, I have had people ask me this question in all the running stores that I've worked in, and so I think it's a good one. When I run, it says, I get the runs. Is there a solution? And the answer to the I get the runs when I run question has been around for a long time. And it's answered a couple different ways. And I don't mean to be crude if you feel that. I'm not trying to be that, but I'm going to answer this quite frankly and quite honestly. First of all, I think you need to do things before you run to get your body ready to run. For example, pretty regular guy. I can get up, have a cup of coffee, attend to nature, and I'm off on a run, and I don't have a problem with the runs. I've established this by doing it for years and years, and pretty much know that I have a cup of coffee, I have to, go to the bathroom, and then I'm out the door, and that's my thing. And again, not to be crude or not to try to, make fun of this, of course not, but that's something you kind of have to play with, almost like the timing of the food with the side stitch question. You have to figure out what's your routine so that you can get your body ready to run. And you probably already know this, most of you, that, some of us are morning runners and we're really good in the morning, and some of us need to kind of have our day behind us before we go and do that. And it's all a circadian rhythm. It's all digestive. It's all a food timing thing. And so again, I really think that it just takes a little bit of time sitting down. And if it's really bothering you, if you're really having a problem with some digestion and some immediate needs of, bowel issues while running, then you need to take the time to kind of journal and sit down and kind of, make notes of when I was good and what was I doing before that. I mean, really back it up in, the 6, 8 hours, 12 hours before, and find out what I ate, what I did, how much fluid I drank, and then just go start looking for clues as to how to fix that. And of course, I am not a doctor, and I don't even play one on TV, but if this continues after you've, done some basic homework, then I think you need to see somebody, because it shouldn't be happening to the point where you're having a lot of distress with that. But those are the questions for this episode of All Things Running Q&A. I hope that since we got a good response off this, I hope that we can do more of these, because I think these questions help a lot of people. And with that said, we're going to take a little break, and I'll be right back with you with the Suunto Watch, new software called Moves Count.
Red Rock Running Company, Las Vegas's finest running store, is located at 7350 West Cheyenne in Las Vegas. We can handle all your running needs: shoes, apparel, hydration, nutrition, running injury and rehab tools. And be sure to check out our treadmill video analysis, taking all the guesswork out of which shoe you should be in. Check us out online at redrockrunningcompany.com and on Facebook and Twitter.
Welcome back. In this next segment, I want to talk about a new software called Moves Count, and it's located at movescount.com. The nice thing about Moves Count is that for years, Suunto users, and Suunto, for those of you unfamiliar, is a watch manufacturer. They make, running specific and triathlon specific watches. And the nice thing about Suunto is that they understand what we're doing as runners, and they don't put a lot of junk in the watch that we don't need. They don't load it up with things that are hard to deal with. And they understand that people have different levels of interest in running, and people want different types of information. And I'm not necessarily talking about beginner and intermediate and advanced runners. I'm talking about, there are some advanced runners that just want some basic information. How long have I been running? Maybe some splits or laps, and they may or may not want to train with heart rate. And Suunto has addressed this in their series of watches. We carry them at the store. We carry the T3, the T4, and the T6. And the T3 is a watch for someone who just doesn't want to be overloaded with information. They want the very basics. They want to know, you know, how long have I been running? Possibly, again, some laps or some splits if they're racing or doing some intervals or some speed work. And, of course, heart rate for the hard days to know if they're, you know, topping out at the high end, or on recovery days to know to go easy. The T3 is the watch that does that. The T4, the difference between the T3 and the T4 is the T4 has a coaching feature. This is nice, again, for someone who wants to kind of take the brain work, the thinking out of running, and have some of that done for them. The T4 from Suunto does that. It basically tells you that here's your workout for today, and the nicest thing about it is it shows you if you're improving or kind of staying the same or overtraining. The coach feature does that. T4 is a wonderful watch for that. Those of you wanting some feedback and some help in deciding how much to do every day with your running. The T6 is the most magnificent watch I've ever seen from a running standpoint as far as what it can do. The T6 does it all. And when I say does it does all the extra stuff that sometimes you kind of get bogged down with and you look at and go, do I really need that? Really? Is that really, I need all that? And the T6 is that watch. So the nice thing about it is that it collects all the data, and it gives you the data while you're running, or you can look at it after you're done. And we're talking about pace per mile. If you have the foot pod, we're talking about the distance. We're talking about altitude, rate of ascent, rate of descent. You know, there's just everything. If you go to their site, and I'll put their website in the show notes so you can go check out these watches online if you like, or you're more than welcome to come in the store and touch and hold and try them on, and we can give you the rundown. But they have a thing called EPOC, and EPOC measures basically how hard you're working out. Little different than the coaching feature in the T4 that I mentioned. EPOC measures your training effect, and it does it very specifically to the taking into the account of the duration of the workout. Was it over a hilly terrain? Because the T6 can calculate that. Heart rate, calories, and it gives you a rating of that workout, and it helps you decide, again, whether you're doing too little or too much in much more detail than the T4 did. Not to take away from the T4, it's fine as a coaching watch, as that coaching feature that we're talking about, but the T6, man, it does it all. Now, you say, okay, great, those are the watches, perfect. How do I look at all this data? How do I manage it? Well, if you go to movescount.com, and the website, again, I'll put it in the show notes if you're not in front of a computer right now, movescount.com, you basically set up a free account. And it asks for all the normal information, create a login, create a password, set up my settings, basically some body metrics, you know, how much do you weigh, how tall are you, where's your fitness level at right now, what do you think your fitness level's at. If you're going to use heart rate zones, you plug in your zones, and then you just basically head out for a run. And when you get back, there's a little piece of software that you install when you have a Suunto watch and you're using Moves Count. It's called Moves Link. You plug the watch into your computer, and all of a sudden, the data is uploaded to Moves Count. Now, this is where it gets really cool, because I like to have as much as I need, but as little as I can get away with when it comes to my data. So I don't like to be overwhelmed by data. I want what I want, and then I'm done. And Moves Count does that. It lets you basically take a look at your run with graphs or with, you know, analog numbers. And then there's also a place that you can log your information. You know, how did I feel? Was it windy? Was it cloudy? Was it really hot? Was it cold? That kind of thing. And it serves as a log, but with feedback, because you have the data that was collected from your watch during your run that you're looking at on Moves Count. We recommend the Suunto watch above all others in the store simply because the ease of use in using the watch, the selection for the different choices that a runner would have. Do I want a lot of information? Do I want to be a data junkie? Do I want to look at every single thing that I do? Do I want to know how much time I spend in each one of my heart rate zones? Or do I just want to go out and run and know my heart rate didn't go so high that my heart was going to jump out of my chest? They have a watch for that. And now with the addition of Moves Count that works on Mac and PC, it's amazing. So I wanted to take a few moments because we're always asked about, you know, what do you use for log? What do you use for software? What do you use to track your data? And the answer is Moves Count. Finally today, what I would like to do is talk to you about a new product, one I think you're going to be very interested in, and one I think that almost everybody that does any kind of distance should consider. And that is a hydration pack, but not just any hydration pack. It's a hydration pack from Nathan. And if you're not familiar with Nathan, Nathan has been making hydration packs for years, and they have made it a mission of theirs to perfect hydration packs. In other words, the carrying of water or fluid on your back. And they have set out to do this, and I think they've done it. And of course, they're still not satisfied because the bar that they've set for themselves is very high. But I think they've done a terrific job with the new pack that they have out now. It's going to be out for quite a while because it takes them a while to develop another one, as you can imagine. But the current pack that I think is just stellar is called the Exceed, X-C-E-E-D, Exceed. And it's a 2-liter pack, and it's an X-pack. And what I mean by X-Pack, and I'll put the Nathan website up, and you guys can take a look at this pack, or as I always recommend, if you're local to Red Rock Running Company in Las Vegas, stop by the store and try it on, because that's all that it takes. You try this pack on, and it fits you like nothing you've ever had on as far as a backpack or a hydration pack. It is a X-Pack. It crosses over in front of you and attaches sternum area. And the nice thing about it, and the first thing you notice, is there's nothing under your arms. There's nothing along your rib cage that makes you feel like you can't take a deep breath. The worst thing in the world is to take off on a run and feel strangled or suffocated. The second worst thing with a hydration pack is to start running up a hill or pick up your pace and begin trying to move more air and not being able to because the pack is so darn tight that it you can't do anything with it. You can't breathe. And Nathan has figured this out, and what they've done is they've got the X-Pack. It attaches to the sternum, the straps are low, and it is very customizable. And I can't stress that enough, how much you can customize the pack. With other brands, you pretty much put the pack on and you're at the mercy of wherever the straps are and wherever they've put the buckles or attachments, that's it. Now, the X-Pack, it adjusts at the shoulder, it adjusts at the sternum and at the waist, and you barely know it's on. In fact, after you move a couple ounces out of the back of the fluid bladder, you really don't even feel that anymore. I mean, you put 2 liters on, you know you've got something on. 2 liters is a lot of water. I won't try to fool you on that one, but literally, once you take a couple sips of water, that sensation of having that weight on your back goes away, and you're left with nothing other than just the joy of running. It's a bite valve. You pull the valve, and then you bite down, and that's how the water delivery happens. There's a storage pocket in the back that you can easily fit iPod or iPhone-sized phone, plus 5 gels, some money, and a credit card. The sternum pocket has a small zipper, which is perfect for storing 2 gels, a packet of Enduralites. And then there's a mesh pocket on the outside, which is perfect for like old gel packs until you can throw them away and that sort of thing. A very comfortable pack. Again, 2 liters. And then let's address the question that usually comes up. How's the bladder inside? Well, first of all, it's a BPA-free bladder, so you don't have to worry about any toxins. And the filling of this bladder is really nice. It's a separate zipper. It does not open from the back. It opens from the inside. So you take the pack off, lift it up over your head, and there's the zipper right there. And you simply open up the zipper, and the bladder is hanging in there. You slide off the slide valve, which is the slide cover to the bladder, and you have a huge wide mouth opening that you can pour into. You can use a spout, you could use garden hose, you can fill it with a jug, and of course, large wide mouth opening means that you can get some ice down in there, which is really nice for us living in southern Nevada. So I really encourage you to take a look at this. And at the beginning, I gave you in my teaser that it was a safety device. I think that you know, at least I hope you know, that our climate from the end of May through parts of September, you know, it's not safe to go out for a run without some sort of hydration. Now, obviously, those of you running shorter runs can get away with a handheld bottle and that sort of thing. But those of us doing any distance at all, and with, of course, with the Las Vegas Marathon coming up, we end up doing part of our training in a relatively hot time of the year. I think the idea of wrapping your brain around carrying plenty of fluid is something you need to do if you're going to be successful. And again, something that's kind of the theme of this podcast, if you're going to enjoy your experience of running, it's best if you're well hydrated and well taken care of out there, because it's going to make the experience much more pleasurable. So I encourage you to come in and take a look at that. It's a staff favorite. Juliet put it on, and one of the first days we got it in, and was just raving to everyone about it, because she comes from having used another brand for years and liked it. I think partly she liked it because it was the only thing around. It was the only game in town as far as hydration. But now, with the Nathan Exceed, there's a new player in town, so to speak, with this hydration pack. So please come in and check it out. Well, folks, that's it for this podcast. Thank you for listening to All Things Running, Red Rock Running Company's weekly podcast. My name's Eric Herdman. I'm the owner of Red Rock Running Company. Please stop by the store. We're located at 7350 West Cheyenne in Las Vegas, Nevada. Our phone number is 702-870-4786. Check us out online at redrockrunningcompany.com and on Facebook and Twitter.